97.1 FM Talk. On demand audio.
I don't even think I've mentioned this. I am so excited about football kickoff tonight. Faurot Field Memorial Stadium with a brand new north end zone. Mizzou against, I think it's a high school team in Arkansas. They're favored by 55 points, but it is our first time to see Austin Simmons, the transfer from Ole Miss, be at the helm for quarterback. So I can't wait for tonight. 7 p.m. kickoff. And my dear friend, we went to J school together. He is one of the great voices on the Tigers radio network. Chris Trevino is going to join me in about an hour. So a lot of stuff happened today in the Lindsey Clancy case. Some of it a little confusing. Phil Holloway is going to join me in about 60 seconds. I want to play something from a reporter who was in the courtroom as some of this was wrapping up today. And the jury has been sent home for the day.
We all thought, the reporters thought, the jury was being pulled on a potential deadlock. They had the 12 deliberating jurors at the bench with Lindsey Clancy actually being wheeled up there to listen to all of this and take it all in. Each one was sworn in, pulled, and then they went out, and then all 18 came back in. This jury has been incredibly hard to read. I believe they are just very tired. They are very stoic. They are very serious. Everybody's exhausted. The jury's exhausted. Mm-hmm. I mean, When the judge instructed them to go back and deliberate again, there were gasps in the courtroom, audible gasps. And I'm sure the jury could hear some of it. I mean, it really has been intense and pretty unbelievable, to be honest.
So they do shut the cameras down through some of this. Phil Holloway back with us, the host of the Megyn Kelly True Crime Show. This has been quite a day. I don't even know how to sum it up because it's been a little back and forth, some guesswork at play this afternoon, and then the jury goes home.
Yeah, it was quite a day, you know. But here's the thing: I mean, this trial is like no other, right? This is going to be one of the famous trials or infamous trials in American jurisprudential history, when all said and done. But on the other hand,
right.
it's not exactly unlike, you know, a lot of other trials that I've been part of that, you know, where there's no cameras in there. You got a jury that is having a hard time following, or they're having a hard time coming up with a verdict because they can't all agree on what to do. My read on this, okay, and this is, it's definitely 11-1. We know that. What we don't know is what the split is. But reading the tea leaves, my prediction, I believe, my speculation is that it's 11-1 in favor of the defense. And let me say why. Before they can get to the question of to find her guilty of a lesser included manslaughter, or is it murder one, murder two, before they can get to those questions, they have to get past the first question, which is she legally insane at the time of the killings? And on that point, the prosecutor must prove, or actually must disprove, the defense's affirmative defense, if you will, beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, the prosecutor has the burden of disproving the claims of the defense that she was mentally ill. They have to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So the defense in Massachusetts, right out of the gate, gets a little shove in favor of not guilty. And so it sounds like that's what happened. It sounds like there was 11 in the jury room that were ready to say, look, maybe she is guilty, but I think the prosecutor didn't prove her guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's one that's holding out for guilty, and that person, I think, today had some kind of meltdown. And the fourth person said, look, I'm just going to send the judge a note asking for some help. And I think that's where we are.
So let me play you Kevin Reddington, because he was really pissed off when this was all going down. And I want to get your reaction to what he said to the judge.
The court has an instruction from the foreperson of that juror that's been working for a week now, saying that there's one juror who refuses to listen to the law that you've given him or her on reasonable doubt. And I suggest respectfully that the soft instruction that you gave them, saying at the sidebar, can you listen to the law as I instruct you, does not focus on the issue. It is, the question is not sufficient enough. It does not allow any foundation for a motion to remove the juror who refuses to accept your instructions on the law, on reasonable doubt. And if we come back here in a half an hour with a mistrial because of a juror that has just spurned the instructions of this court, it's a shame. It's a real shame. And that's why I object to the court's ruling. I request that we have further inquiry. I request that my motion is to remove this juror that refuses to listen to your instruction on reasonable doubt.
All right, so the judge refused that, but let me go to some of the points that he was making, because, you know, essentially to your point, it seems like Kevin Reddington also feels like this is 11-1 in his favor. Now, he would really have no real way of knowing that, right? Isn't that still kind of guesswork on his part?
Maybe, but what he said was there was one juror that was refusing to follow the judge's instructions on reasonable doubt. To me, that can only mean one thing. It can only mean that the person is may believe with that. Okay, it may say, "Look, I agree with y'all. They didn't disprove, you know, her defense beyond a reasonable doubt, but I just can't vote not guilty because what she did is so terrible." I think right. There's a holdout that just doesn't want to acquit her. I'm reading into the language, but it's the instruction was about reasonable doubt. The foreperson said the person is not following your instructions on reasonable doubt. And Reddington has been in that courtroom with these people for what, 5 or 6 weeks now?
Mm-hmm.
He knows the jurors who are leaning his way and the ones who might not be. So you combine what the note actually said or what we're told that it said with, you know, Reddington being in that courtroom with them. Trust me on this, lawyers get a sense for who's with them and who might not be. You put that together, and to me, the most reasonable conclusion is that it's 11-1 in favor of not guilty by reason of insanity.
You know, Phil, before my show today, I went back and I read all of Kevin Reddington's, I read the transcript, I didn't watch it, but I read the transcript of his closing argument. I had heard it at the time, and then read the transcript from the prosecution closing argument as well. His closing argument, and we talked about this at the time, it was just awful. It was all over the place. He had forgotten names of people. It wasn't cohesive at all. It was almost like there was a lack of preparation. And again, a lot of that may be stood out more because he had done a job, and the conventional wisdom from those people who are watching this trial every day is the defense did a pretty good job of making their case. But man, closings were just a mess for him. So I still think this is fascinating. If we're still hinging here, that means the jury went home though, and they're going to go back tomorrow morning and deliberate, right? It's not going to be a situation where they come back right away and say, we're hung. They'll have to go back to work tomorrow, won't they?
Well, they will, but before they do that, Reddington has announced this afternoon after court was over that there's going to be some type of a hearing in the morning at 9 o'clock where the single juror is going to be, you know, questioned by the judge. And I think that's the right call. The judge has to decide, look, is this person refusing to deliberate? If they're refusing to participate in deliberations, they can be removed and have a alternate substitute in. But if the person says, "No, I'm fine. I'm cooperating. I'm just following your instruction, Judge. You said to hold on to my firmly held belief, mm-hmm. you know, and not to compromise my convictions, and that's what I'm doing." If that's the case, then the judge really has no choice, and they can't remove that juror. The question becomes: okay, are we going to let him keep working, or is this going to be a mistrial?
Right.
But you know, I agree with you on your point about closings. Reddington's was a little wandering and didn't seem to have a lot of purpose, and seemed to be a little disjointed is the right word. But the prosecutors did a better job, but they didn't do so great of a job either. This case was won or lost based on the evidence that came out in the courtroom during the course of the trial. I think the jury was kind of cemented then. Closings probably didn't sway them one way or the other very much.
So I'm a little confused on the issue of alternates. And, you know, you've been in a courtroom a lot more than me, but I always remember that jury alternates were there for the testimony. Then as soon as a jury went into deliberation, they were excused. And maybe that's a Missouri thing or something like that. But in this particular situation, do we literally have alternate jurors that are just standing by? I mean, they're not in that deliberation room, right?
No, they're not. But they're in the courthouse. They're often in a separate room. And here's the thing. If one of them has to be substituted in, the deliberations have to start all over from the beginning.
That's
and
my point.
Each state does it a little differently. I've always wondered why some states literally send them home, because they might need to be called back. The only reason I could think to send them home would be to try to save money, because they still have to be paid their daily per diem, their 25 or 30 bucks, whatever it is for the day. So they might save a few bucks by sending them home and having them be on call. But where I practice, in most of the cases I've been involved with, the judges prefer to have the alternates close by in case they need to substitute in. But they have to sit there in another room. But when they're when court is in session, like it was today, they came back in. You notice they brought all the alternates back in. And the argument in favor of keeping them at the courthouse is so that they can come back in and watch and see everything that goes on in open court, even during the deliberation process.
You know, when I was reading those closing arguments, I also noted what the judge said to the jurors. And at one point, the judge said, about 5 weeks ago that we met like this, I indicated to you and I thank you for incredible service. And all of us mean that sincerely. You took literally more than a month out of your lives and sat here. That's simply incredible. Through some of the toughest, most gut-wrenching things that any person can be subjected to. And I indicate that sadly, juries carry this trauma with them for years. I've talked about that a little bit this week, Phil, because I can't even imagine being someone on this jury that has seen these pictures, that's heard the 911 call that the rest of us have not heard, that's, you know, listened even in the courtroom to Lindsey Clancy, you know, crying and screams in the courtroom. All these things are going to take a toll on this jury in ways that are probably a little bit unimaginable. I can't imagine being someone who's had to see all this evidence.
No, and I'm glad I didn't have to see it. The prosecutor went a long way. They made a strong point in making sure they used the gruesome pictures. They used the gruesome autopsy pictures and the crime scene pictures over the act of the killings, which was not contested. So they didn't necessarily have to do that, but they wanted to try to leverage that. So like if she's getting any sympathy from the jury, any jurors who are identifying with postpartum or things of that nature, they wanted to try to offset that with really, really horrific testimony. And it's a trial tactic, and you can draw your own opinion on whether or not they should have done that. But it's definitely something that traumatizes these jurors, and they will absolutely never forget it. And a lot of them are probably going to need counseling when this is over.
I think they will be. And it's going to also be interesting. I mean, sometimes we have cases, jurors come out and they talk a little bit, right? Sometimes they don't. So I think a lot of us, you know, and this is just this fascination we have in this country with cases like this. And I think you're right. It's going to go down as one that people will remember. What's interesting is that for the first 3 weeks, there was not a lot of attention on this case, right? But as we got closer to the end and then more people, and I think what caught people's attention is the nature of the support that Lindsey Clancy was getting from women in particular outside of the courtroom. And again, I've had empathy, Phil. You know, I missed 2 months of work because of my mental health last year. I have empathy for Lindsey Clancy having postpartum depression, but that's a long way from a psychosis that they had to prove in that courtroom. So we're going to see what happens. Thank you, as always, Phil Holloway, host of the Megyn Kelly True Crime Podcast. Have a great Labor Day weekend, Phil.
You too, my friend. And hey, you know, we may have a verdict tomorrow.
Well, we might. We may talk tomorrow. You're right about that.
Get more at 971talk.com.